You're listening to Robert Wright's Non-Zero Podcast.
Hello, Derek and Danny.
Hello, Bob.
Hi, Bob.
So this is another High Synergy crossover podcast co-produced by the American Prestige Podcast. That's you guys, and the Non-Zero Podcast. That's me. Where we talk about foreign policy, and Danny tries to turn me into a socialist.
Have you done the reading that I sent you, Bob? Have you read?
I haven't, but you know what? You know what I realized is I don't want to get converted, because one thing I learned over the last few days is that if I do, I can not get a job at the University of Boston, also known as Barry White. Did you read
Barry's not around very much, according to
that
article.
That's why they haven't returned any of my calls.
Oh, yeah. You only have to read the beginning to realize that socialists will not be teaching.
This is so unfair. Oof. I have to read all the liberal stuff and the conservative stuff, and you guys don't have to read my stuff. This is not fair. I don't think this is a true education that we're receiving in this country any longer. Back in the day, they knew Marx. I mean, if you go back to the 50s, Bob, you probably actually have at some point. A lot of these social science texts, it was like...
I was alive in the 50s.
You were alive. It was like de rigueur to always have like a chapter on why Marxism is wrong. So like Kenneth Waltz, if I'm remembering correctly, in his first book based on his dissertation, The Book Man, the State and War, he has like the obligatory, like, this is why Marx doesn't work chapter. And a lot of books, I mean, that's a famous one, but a lot of books at the time like have that. Those guys like Walt Whitman Rostow like knew Marx. They really, really read it. And that by the time I think the boomers were being educated, like went away. But if you were educated in the 30s and the 40s, you like seriously engaged with Marx. It was one of the major texts. And I think that should return. It's a major strand of social thought.
Okay. I'll do it. I'll read all the stuff you've been sending me. Well, we'll talk about it next time. So wait, we have not had one of these conversations since the year began. And although the year is only what, 3 weeks old, much has happened on the foreign policy scene. Give you a quick recap of the part I remember, at least. The U.S. staged a brief and finite invasion of Venezuela, which
not
led
according to the prediction markets. That wasn't an invasion, Bob. that was something else.
They didn't pay off for invasion?
They didn't, right?
They're not paying out. I don't know. I didn't follow the story beyond the one report I saw that they were refusing to pay out.
Oh my God.
Yeah, so don't you dare call it an invasion.
This explains why the rules-based order is not working. It's a definition problem. We'll get to that, actually, because it's not, but also because for the first time, Canada's prime minister actually pointed that out. So Venezuela, this led to the involuntary relocation of the president and his wife. Venezuela's not America's, for better or worse. Trump said that if Iran killed any protesters, he would attack it or something, and then they killed some protesters, and he didn't. And then apparently he just wasn't in the mood to attack Iran, period, at least for a while.
Well, he may still be. Reporting this week has been he's still asking for options from his people.
He may, and we will get to that. Then he started saying again, he wants Greenland. We are going to possess it the easy way or the hard way. In other words, if we have to use military force, we will. Then the stock market tanked after he made another threat. In fact, a vow that he would raise tariffs on these several European countries that didn't seem to be on board with his Greenland plan. And then he walked all of this back, said he wouldn't use force. The tariffs are off because he's gotten what he wanted, even though it's pretty clear that what he said he wanted, he's not going to get, which is actual ownership of Greenland, at least not this time around. Let's just look at today's Wall Street Journal. Here's a headline. The U.S. is actively seeking regime change in Cuba by the end of the year. I don't know. What have I forgotten? It's been
one week since you looked at me.
Alarm over Greenland threat gives way to uncertainty around Trump's future deal. Yeah. He says that he has, quote, the concept of the deal. He said that. So I don't know where to begin. I don't know that we can take three more years of this at this pace. But...
Well, Bob, I have a question. Do you agree that this is, with Carney and his speech at Davos, that this is a rupture? Because obviously, I think a lot of the response after 2016 was that this was an interregnum and that Biden would restore order. I mean, that's what he came into office doing. Gaza obviously really derailed, I think, that project. But do you think this is like we're at an apocalypse break, essentially?
Well, actually, you know, I was going to ask you guys a related question, which is like, how much of what's happening is kind of structural and how much is just Trump? So, for example, one might have predicted 10 years ago that, look, we're going to have some kind of Pat Buchanan-like president who will appeal to the American people and maybe get elected. And Donald Trump, on paper, is a Pat Buchanan-like president. But Buchanan isn't nearly this crazy or as disrespectful of norms and rules and so on. And you know, related, another thing maybe you could have predicted, maybe related to that is, you know, Europe's going to have to become more self-sufficient in terms of national security, less dependent on the U.S. These are kinds of things one might have said are, you know, tectonic plate types things. I don't know. As opposed to Trump type things. So my question is,
and China being the obvious other one, right? That China was going to assert regional hegemony and that the U.S. Those are the big, I think those are the big three you just mentioned. Yeah. Post global war on terror, Europe and China.
But this could have been going a lot more smoothly if those three things had happened and Trump not been the manifestation of some of them, right?
Well, I think the thing that I think people like Derek and I have been making that argument for a decade. I really started writing about foreign policy in public about a decade ago, and a piece I wrote for Harper's in 2022 does make that argument about China. You just look at like share of global GDP, right? It's just down, and has been for decades. So those are the sort of tectonic plate shifts and things like that. But the problem also just wasn't Trump, but the problem was that like the foreign policy establishments never planned for any of it. Because you have the Obama pivot to Asia in like 2011, 2012, and you basically just still have the permanent bureaucracy and also the not bureaucracy. Foreign policy is not unique, but was one of the first issue areas. Like a lot of it is done outside of the government and think tanks and you know places like that. That was a choice that was made in the 40s to basically headquarter research, most of it not in the government. But a lot of those people weren't taking cognizance of these tectonic shifts. So it allowed, I think, someone like Trump and the coterie around him to come in and just basically be like a bull in a china shop because there was no planning for what, to my, and I speaking on Derek's behalf, Derek's minds, was just very obvious that it's not 1946 and it's not 1990 any longer. And like, clearly these things are going to change. But there was such intellectual inertia within the foreign policy bureaucracy and the think tank world that there was no planning for it. It's really wild.
So what would you guys have done? Derek, what would you have done in preparation for these tectonic shifts?
I mean, I think... From the perspective of the United States, I mean, we've talked about this. Like, the missed opportunity for the U.S. was in the 1990s when you could have ceded formal levers of power to international institutions that were all based on the same, you know, principles that the U.S. has been running its empire for you know, decades. You had a moment, that unipolar moment, where you could have said, okay, let's really strengthen the UN. Let's really strengthen, you know, and I'm not saying this would have been a good thing necessarily. I'm not, you know, a huge fan of the institutions, especially when you get into, you know, things like the IMF and the World Bank. But if you were trying to inculcate a system where the United States was going to stay on top of the heap indefinitely, the way to do it was not to just, assume unto the U.S., you know, unchecked power to do whatever it wants, because that's ephemeral. That's going to go away when, as Danny says, the GDP starts to shift, when the economic center of gravity starts to move, when you get a situation like Ukraine, where you've got a regional power that just is more committed to what they want to do than the United States could possibly be. Like, that's going to fall apart. But if you had institutionalized some of these things, That would have been, to me, the answer to, you know, future shocks against the system.
Yeah, I agree. I was making an argument that's very closely related, maybe a little different in emphasis. I mean, you said if the U.S. wants to stay on top of the heap. What I was saying is, look, obviously, we're not going to be the most economically powerful nation forever, judging by China's trajectory. So it seems to make sense that we would want to construct a world in which might isn't the only thing that makes right. People actually respect the rules and so on. And I was saying, yeah, the UN is the best we got. Let's nourish it. It actually looked like we might, but we didn't. And I would say, had we really talked that talk a little more loudly and walked the walk, which would have meant, you know, George H.W. Bush doesn't invade Panama, Bill Clinton doesn't bomb Serbia, we don't invade Iraq and so on, I think we could have arranged things so that Ukraine never gets invaded. I mean, we wouldn't have expanded NATO, for one thing, if we'd had any brains and understood the world to come. But yeah, I mean, so we kind of agree, it sounds like, shockingly. Is there disagreement?
Even in a more short-term perspective, let's say like it's 2010, there were some obvious things you could do. For example, in East Asia, you could have begun a genuine security transition with U.S. allies in the region, as opposed to just not do that. You could have done a similar thing in Europe in a genuine way. You could have been like, the U.S. is probably not going to backstop European defense until eternity. We're going to actually reduce funding in a serious way. So mm-hmm. even in the more medium term perspective, you could have, you know, let's say you're drunk on Cold War victory in the 90s and you're not going to do the UN, whatever. But when the writing was very clearly on the wall, nothing was done. And that really is an abdication of responsibility for people who advocate U.S. quote unquote leadership. It's quite wild.
And there, I mean, there are things that Trump has done in a cruder way mm-hmm. that achieve those same aims. Like if in 2010 or, you know, around that time you had said to the European members of NATO, like, look, this situation, like the imbalance in terms of military spending, in terms of the degree to which, you know, this is a U.S. Operation rather than a shared burden. It just can't continue like this. You're going to have to start increasing your defense spending. You're going to have to, you know, contribute more to the alliance, we could just dissolve it. But of course, that was not a possibility at that point. But like, if you had said it, if you had that conversation in 2010, you wouldn't be in, you know, 2025, 2026 with Trump basically saying, like, you know, spend 5% of GDP or else we're out. Like, and that's the same net effect. It's just you could have done it in a more graduated kind of
and almost anybody would have. I mean, almost any president, plausible president, certainly including Pat Buchanan, who was more or less like Trump ideologically, would have just done this in a more rational and coherent way, I think.
Right.
I mean, does he seem to you guys like he really is getting less stable? I mean, of course.
Yeah. That's obvious.
It's crazy. Yeah. Although, there's always the crazy like a fox argument, which I as a rule don't buy. But I will say this.
With Nixon in his when he was like in his 50s, maybe, not Trump 80 years old, you know, context.
I think one goal you can say he does rationally and systematically serve is 16. To stay in the headlines. And that's a big goal of his. It's like, you know, most people would say, hey, if I come out of the box saying I'm going to take Greenland by force if I have to, and I'm going to levy these tariffs like tomorrow to make sure this happens, and then the stock market starts to crash and I back off, most people would say, oh my God, I'd look so silly. No, for Trump, that means 2 days of headlines instead of one. And It's like it proves that he controls the stock market. Now, I'm not saying I don't think he thought the whole thing through, but I do think that when this happens, it's not the kind of negative feedback for him that it is for a lot of people, because he did, in a sense, demonstrate his power. And he was in the headlines 2 days in a row instead of one.
Well, and I mean, you could argue that that's evidence that he's not deteriorating, because he's been like that for 20 years. Like, he just wants his name in the freaking newspaper. It's not a question of why or you know what he's in the newspaper for. It's the publicity that he craves. He just likes to see his name on the front page, or he likes to see all of his friends on the TV mm-hmm. on his favorite TV shows talking about him. And so, yeah, I mean, it does work out for him in that way. I think, you know, where it starts to look like he's losing it, I think, is when you get the final outcome, or I don't know if it's going to be the final outcome, but the outcome that we have gotten to on Greenland, and it's something he could have had on January 21st, 2025. Like, yeah. We didn't have to go through this year of like histrionics over this. This is an arrangement he could have had at any time.
Well, he could have had roughly the deal he's going to get in Venezuela with Maduro in place. That is an authoritarian regime and some concessions.
It just does
and
his
shit.
Bidding. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. But instead, he'd rather do yet more damage to, you know, norms and international law and kill some people. And same thing's going to happen in Cuba. In fact, what the administration is supposedly talking about is like a Venezuela-like deal. Well, you can do right. that without invading, okay? You know, they will do a deal. They are not enthusiastic about the sanctions we've been levying against them for like 11 centuries, okay?
In particular with Cuba, like, I don't even know how you would do a Maduro operation in Cuba. There's no analogous figure. Like, Miguel Diaz-Canel is not to Cuba. The analogy... It doesn't hold up. Like, he's not to Cuba as Nicolas Maduro was to the Venezuelan government. Like, he's not dominating that system. If you go in and pluck him out in the dead of night, like, I don't think that's an analogous situation. The solution, as you say, is to just, you know, get these guys to recognize or you pressure the Cuban government into just doing what you want and leave it in place.
But I think they want the... token deposing of the leader. I think that's what they're hoping is they won't have
sure,
to obey.
Yeah. Kennedy couldn't do it. The CIA couldn't do it. Absolutely. Like that.
It's
that's
just not. It's
wants.
A pale yeah. imitation. Like, this is not Fidel Castro. Like, you're not taking yeah. out. You're not taking out an overawing figure in a great military. This is a functionary. This is a party functionary that you would be going after, I assume, if he was the target.
Well, this is the Rubio thing. Rubio clearly has made mm-hmm. this his life mission. And I think that there's future historians, all three of us are going to look back on this. And there was clearly an intense Florida contingent towards the foreign policy here. That and actually, Florida plays long played an interesting role. That's where George H.W. Bush cut his teeth. In the Florida task force, an anti-drug task force in the early 80s. So there's like this whole history of Floridian foreign policy. And I think to a large degree, we're seeing that play out now. I mean, Miami is classically one of the major cities of Latin America. It's part of the Latin America sort of larger sphere. There's a lot of people there. And I think that a lot of this Latin America Donroe Doctrine stuff is a reflection of the Floridian right-wing foreign policy, which is why I do think if I were a prediction market and I was forced to bet, I'm not a betting man, but it does seem like they were going to at least try something in Cuba. I think it is symbolically very important to that group. And Trump will love being like, all these other presidents couldn't do it, but I did it. Seems like a lot of things lining up for some sort of intervention there.
Yeah. I still say what the world most needs now is on a magazine cover that Trump would see. I mean, isn't one of the things that doomed Bannon last time around some kind of Time magazine cover that depicted Bannon what? As a literal puppet.
Yeah, also Kissinger and Nixon. That's what got Nixon really pissed at Kissinger. He was probably going to fire Kissinger. They were named dual man of the year, I think, 72. And he was going to fire him, except Watergate happened. Whoops.
We need a magazine cover that says the deep state is back and then shows Marco Rubio as the puppeteer and, you know, Trump being manipulated. That might get Rubio started toward the exits of the White House. I don't know.
He's out of it. I mean, like, Bob, I think we shouldn't. I think he is really out of it in a way that he wasn't in the first
Trump.
Term.
You mean Trump?
Trump, yeah. So it's very difficult to read any
like,
of this stuff.
What is he?
Falling
is he
asleep? I mean, he keeps
he's
falling asleep.
He's very out
meetings.
Of it.
I'm falling yeah. asleep, and I'm significantly younger. I mean, I'm going to be dead when I'm his age.
What did he?
Is he 80?
What was
he, is he
the other day? I mean, he gave his speech about Greenland and like called it Iceland like
he
three
called
times
it Iceland
and then,
like four times in a row. I mean, it wasn't like one time. He just kept calling it Iceland.
And then the explanation from the White House is like, no, he was calling it an Iceland or something, like some ridiculous thing like that. Yeah. Like, come on,
see,
man.
That's why I call America Greenland, because of the trees. See, I do that all the time.
I have a question. So it does seem like Trump is increasingly unpopular with the mythical median voter, particularly with this ice invasion of Minneapolis and the sort of the ice becoming a form of executive police in a way that it like had glimmers of, but is obviously different under Trump. Do you think that were a Democrat to win in 2028, there are going to be consequences? Because I think one of the things that has defined American politics. Yeah, I kind of, Derek shaking his head. No, I kind of agree. So this is, we're talking, you know, Korea is in the news these days and they might sentence Derek Wright, the former prime minister, to death. So like different political
culture, probably not. Prison.
Yeah. But it's just like
execution.
That to me is like a big, cause like this is, I think from my understanding, very, very unpopular. So it's just going to be like, President Gruesome Gavin Newsom or Buttigieg or AOC, and it's just going to like go forward. It seems like there's a rupture here that...
Wait, elaborate on the consequences you're asking if we'll see.
Well, if someone broke a law, like if a government official broke a law, who's not the president, because the president is able to break the law, yeah, according to the Supreme Court in the execution of his duties.
That was a helpful ruling.
Yeah, that was good. Like, is it just going to be like moving on? That seems less and less possible. You know, I think it does seem like we're in the past the Obama, we tortured some folks era. But I don't know.
I don't think so. I mean, they didn't prosecute anybody after Trump won. They didn't really prosecute Trump. I mean, they started these cases,
but
it was not seriously done. I mean, if you had been serious, though, if you wanted to prevent him from running for president again, and I guess nobody really thought he was going to or something, you know, initially, like, or that it was impossible that he could get elected again. But you would have started those cases on like day one of the new administration and really pursued them. And it was just half-assed. Like the whole thing was very, very half-assed. And it wasn't, you're right, it wasn't, you know, we tortured some folks, but it's time to, you know, let the past be the past. It wasn't that egregious, but it still wasn't a serious,
well,
you didn't get any serious sense that like, we're upholding the rule of law, or that we believe that it applies to everybody, and we're going to demonstrate that by, you know, actually prosecuting wrongdoing.
And this is my hot take, which I want to get on record here. I actually think that resistance liberalism and Trumpism exist in a dialectical relationship, and that you cannot understand Trump 2.0 without understanding the failed political strategy of resistance liberalism.
I was saying
and so
that.
This is why all those takes, well, just very quickly, Bob, this is when Michelle Goldberg quoted me in the Times in an attempt
recent?
At a dunk.
Is that recent? I missed it.
It was like last week. About the resistance liberals are right. I think that's missing the sort of like relationship that political ideology actually exists within Trump, and they actually feed off of each other. And I don't think you could understand the intensification of Trump 2.0 without understanding particularly the failed lawfare strategy of the broad resistance liberals. I think that is a boondoggle,
little
to say the
fact,
least.
My newsletter, Non-Zero Newsletter, was originally called the Mindful Resistance Newsletter, started right after Trump was elected. And the premise of the whole newsletter was the resistance was too energetic for its own good. They were overreacting it for strategic purposes and playing into his hands. And I think it's true. I think if you take away like Russiagate, and for that matter, the two would-be prosecutions near the end of Biden's term and things like that and reactions like that, I don't know that Trump has the political energy to have become president again. But anyway, I agree. I mean, yeah, there's a symbiosis. Look, there's always a symbiosis between the extreme elements on two sides. There's a symbiosis between Netanyahu and Hamas. There's a symbiosis, you know, that's life. And
oh, Bob, cool it with the anti-Israel rhetoric, okay? Derek and I don't sign on.
I just called Hamas extreme implicitly. Some people, I may catch shit for that too. But that reminds, well, actually, okay, hot take. Here's my hot take, and we'll never know, but it's speculation. I'm wondering if one reason Trump suddenly revived the Greenland thing and intensified it was to try to get the Renee Good story behind him. That was not working for him. I mean, I don't know if you guys looked at the like aggregate approval ratings. Go look at the Real Clear Politics aggregate approval rating. In the days after that, his net negative rating went from something like -8 to -13, and he hasn't recovered much of that ground. You got Joe Rogan's comparing ICE agents to Gestapo officers.
Someone on our Discord called them the Gestapo. I thought that was pretty funny.
That's not nice.
But that's not nice to be mean to the secret police. I'm sorry.
Gestapo as opposed to Gestapo. I kind of wonder about that.
It was the Maduro operation that got everybody like suddenly nervous about Greenland. I mean, he did appoint Jeff Landry as his envoy. Right around Christmas, I think, which kind of got everybody thinking about it again. But then I thought it was the Maduro operation that made everybody think this guy will just do whatever he wants. He's not going to like follow the rules here. He'll just go in and take Greenland.
Well, also it's positive reinforcement, you know, for him. It's like, hey, here's a little, you know, militarism gets positive because it worked for him. He thinks at least, I mean, he didn't, you know, it doesn't seem to have hurt him politically. And so before you know it, he's talking about both bombing Iran and seizing Greenland.
No, I mean, he had even these Europeans who, you know, are so upset about him. And so, you know, it's these tariffs, they're horrible. And what are you doing? We're like, well, you know, I mean, we think it probably violated international law, but Nicolas Maduro was a terrible man and we're so happy to see him gone. Like, you know, what are you doing? Like, you can't stand up for any principle here, apparently. Like, it has to be.
This is where I think some damage has been done by the turn taken in international law circles over whenever, as kind of personified by Samantha Power, toward internal intervention in nations to solve human rights problems. And look, it's very well motivated and so on, but it keeps not working. It keeps leading to horrible outcomes, like in Libya. And I really try to emphasize the distinction between what I consider the bedrock of international law, at least to the extent that the UN Charter is the foundation of it, which is respect for the sovereignty of nations, which means no, you don't under any circumstances attack them, no matter how much you dislike their leadership, unless, you know, like Holocaust level shit is going on. Or they attack you, of course. And distinguish between that and what so many people associate with international law, you know, which winds up amounting to regime change in the name of human rights and democracy. So that's my sermon.
Yeah, I think, we got very invested in the responsibility to protect doctrine that's there for the a while. And that just like, has warped people's understanding of what is actually supposed to be the principle here, which is non-aggression, and
exactly
under which the Maduro thing, it just flat out like is does not fit within that system,
not even close. And I mean, it's closer to complying to national law, U.S. law, because there was an indictment of him. Right,
but you can't do that.
That doesn't get you off the hook so far as international law is concerned.
Right, it's expressly, I mean, you can't indict somebody, you can't substitute domestic law for international law and then say, well, this guy, like, we indicted him, so now we can go get him in violation of all these other things. Like, that system, just on a practical level, could not survive, because you could just indict whoever you want and then go do whatever you want to them. And then there is no international structure that could contain that.
Right.
Well, the problem with all this stuff is that they tried to leapfrog the creation of a genuine international political community by identifying the United States with the international community. This has been a problem of this country from the beginning. It's baked in from John Winthrop's sermon in 1630, the city up on a hill thing. So I think we're really just seeing that project coming apart. You can't have law at a scale when there's no political community to support that law, or regulation. And the responsibility to protect is the perfect example of that, that you have one group acting on behalf of the entire globe without the entire political community of the globe, or at least a majority of it, agreeing to it. And I think this is why, Bob, international law as enacted, maybe not theoretically, but as enacted, was doomed to fail, because it's that fundamental problem of scale that wasn't based on a genuine political community.
I don't know. I think if we confined ourselves to the amount of cynicism that is embodied in the UN, in other words, the powerful countries will collectively run the world. I mean, that's kind of a, you know, that's not a pure justice or global democracy, but that is the idea. All fight, you know, Russia, China, us, and well, France and England, things change, but whatever, they're still there and they get a veto like us. But the point is, you know, it was the countries that prevailed in World War II that set it up so that they could run the world. As it happens, they did constitute the predominance of power. So, you know, that you could call that a cynical version of international law. But if the U.S. had had the presence of mind to at least just leave it at that, I think we'd be okay. Well, and actually nourished the norm of complying with security.
I actually just pitched a piece on this right now. I hope it gets accepted if the editor is listening. But I mean, this is the shift from FDR to Truman. FDR's vision of the United Nations was the four policemen vision, is that you would essentially have these spheres of influence and that people would be able to act legally within them, using essentially the UN as a meeting space for the various great powers. Truman essentially arrogated that to just the United States having the legitimacy to act internationally. The Soviet Union under Truman, not under Roosevelt, was viewed as fundamentally illegitimate, and that was the problem. Now, I think if Roosevelt had lived... Sorry, yes.
So what did Truman do? I mean, I don't doubt that he did. I'm just not that conversant in that part of history.
This is a really good, I recommend it. Sergei Rodchenko's recent book, To Run the World, is a really excellent history of the Soviet Union international relations through like reading all, and not only Soviet Union, but China as well. And he's really reading a lot of documents that have been declassified. And Stalin was, he argues persuasively, fundamentally a realist. And so was Roosevelt. And they were willing to get along. You know, they were willing to be like, this is your space and this is my space. Truman, I think, was not. He was an ideologue in a genuine way. He was extraordinarily anti-communist, much more anti-communist than a lot of the internationalists, quote unquote, who operated within the New Deal state, certainly way more anti-communist than Roosevelt. And he essentially viewed the Soviet Union as illegitimate, that you couldn't deal with them. Make a deal with them. FDR was very different. I think we're returning to an FDR world.
Okay, but are you saying Truman violated international law in the way subsequent presidents did, or just that by kind of contributing to the Cold War, he kind of deadlocked the UN as an effective...
Well, he said the U.S. would just support every anti-totalitarian force, you know, in the Truman Doctrine speech of March 1947. So international law was still in formation, but with that speech, he was essentially declaring the entire globe within the remit of U.S. foreign policy, which I would argue was against the spirit and the letter of the emergent international law that was coming out in the mid to late 1940s. I don't think Roosevelt would have said, we're going to fund every anti-communist force around the world. Truman said that. And then you have, you know, Korea and all these things. And I don't think that FDR, were he alive, would have pursued them maybe at all in the way that Truman did. Initially, as you guys know, Korea was not considered within the U.S. like ambit. It was like, that's very far outside where we are. Mm-hmm. Acheson, I believe, says this at some point. And then Truman basically builds the Cold War in Korea and gets National Security Council document and 68 passed, which essentially funds the Cold War. And I think it's very different world if FDR doesn't die.
I think it's true to the extent that you blame him for the Cold War. The Cold War certainly just paralyzed the Security Council as a mechanism. I mean, ironically, that actually led to the Security Council validating the U.S. position on Korea, because the Russians weren't there. They were weren't there for the vote or something. So they failed to veto it or something like that. But that actually had Security Council backing, I think, ironically. But I agree, you know, the Cold War got us out of the habit of paying any attention to, you know, a formal mechanism for validating international law and that part of international law. And it looked at first like George H.W. Bush was really going to try to revive it. You know, he took great pains with the Persian Gulf War to get it through the Security Council. He had been a UN ambassador, but then Panama was just too tempting or something. And, you know, I really think it was an opportunity for the U.S. to change.
Well, this is the military stuff. I think the revolution in military affairs is really crucial here. And I think that is like half of the story that just isn't told in the foreign policy arena as much, which is that they really thought you could just do wars extraordinarily quickly and cheaply using advanced technology like GPS. And the Gulf War validated that. And it was also supported by the quote unquote international, the coalition of the willing, the international community. And so like, I think there was also this like fantasy about what war is. And so what you're seeing with Trump is like a combination of this revolution in military affairs, which are these like super precise actions, whether you're talking about Soleimani or whether you're talking about Maduro. Interesting, both take place on January 3rd, which indicates that, you know, Trump understands new season, you need something spectacular to find it, to begin it. But with a return to this sort of four policemen model of international relations. So you have this like strange blending of old and new, this is what I hope to argue in this article, this sort of strange blending of old and new that is going to, I think, define geopolitics. And I just don't know where the Democrats stand on any of this, which is, you know, kind of bad. I don't think the Democrats have much of a foreign policy bench. They have like Jake Sullivan and people who served in the Biden administration or with Blinken and Hillary Clinton and Obama. And I just don't know what they're going to do in this new world. I genuinely have no idea. They are a total blank slate to me.
They don't want to talk about it. They don't even want to talk about ICE killing people on American streets. I mean, if you notice, everything out of elected Democrats, with rare exceptions, over the last few weeks has been like, what does X have to do with the price of eggs? Like, they want to take everything back to this question of affordability because they feel like they're on safe ground there. Like, they're not going to piss anybody off, which I understand to some degree. If you feel like that's your best rhetorical weapon, you feel like that's your best political wedge to use against Trump, but it comes off as so inhuman. Like, it's just so mechanical. And I feel like the impression that gives to voters is just so off-putting. It's like, you know, somebody got shot three times by a federal agent on the street for no reason, like just got gunned down. Mm-hmm. And you're trying to bend that back to like, you know, the price of milk went up 2% last month. Like, you know, read the room. Like, even if that's your best issue, read the fucking room and respond to what is actually going on here. Respond to the fact that we just invaded another country and shattered international law again in the process. Or respond to the fact that this man is, you know, threatening to invade Greenland. You know, be a little responsive to what people actually see taking place.
Now
they're reaching Whig level of ineffectiveness, but I don't think anything's going to change. It's wild.
You're talking about the Democrats' rhetoric. I missed that part.
Yeah.
I mean, they you know, they talked about the Renee Good shooting. God knows. I mean, in a way, with that as a political matter, they could do fairly well by just letting the Republicans hang themselves. I honestly think some of the shit that, like J.D. Vance said, if you use that video well, that's not going to be his friend should he find himself in a general election in a few years, which is,
he
of
seems
course,
to have bad political instincts. I mean, I agree with the take that it does seem like Trump saw that video and was like, okay, J.D., take it from here. Like Trump, yes, Trump has good. Show. That seems correct. It does seem like he has good political instincts. But also, Bob, we should probably go to overtime, right? It's been about 45 minutes.
So, okay. So to watch the rest. I want to talk about Renee Good more in overtime. I want to ask Derek about Syria too. Maybe even get to this Mark Carney thing that he famously said at Davos about you know, hypocrisy and so on, and the rules-based order, get it clear on exactly what he was saying. But I do have some new, I think at least one new thought on Renee Good anyway. So yeah, and over time, that's accessible to paid subscribers to either the Non-Zero newsletter or American Prestige, which has both like Non-Zero, both a newsletter and a podcast manifestation, I believe.
FX is the podcast. FX is a newsletter. That's Derek's excellent newsletter. I think anyone should subscribe to it.
Technically,
no, we don't. We have a Substack that we occasionally send emails to, but we don't have a newsletter. I was actually thinking about maybe doing that, Derek.
So, to become paid subscribers, non-zero, they obviously go to the newsletter and you check out this episode and that'll get them past the paywall if they sign up. But what are they? So how do they become paid subscribers?
AmericanPrestigePod.com. Just go to that again, okay. AmericanPrestigePod.com. Click join now. $5 a month, $50 a year, $60 a year, and you get a nation annual subscription.
And then separately, Derek's newsletter, Foreign Exchanges, is well worth what you pay, whether you pay or not. The paid version is well worth it. And God knows the free version is worth it. Without further ado, thanks everybody who's stuck with us this far. Hope you'll follow us into overtime.